You are entering the Royals Podcast Network.
A show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
Belted to left field. Billy comes through tonight. Splash!
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
And welcome into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Ladies and gentlemen, it has been a few weeks. There's been some holidays. There's been some things in, like, normal life and whatnot that has gotten in the way. But we are back again recording the show. We're going to try some new things. It's a new year. We're going to try some new things with the show. So hopefully you like it. Stay tuned. But first things first, I am your host, Jeff Herr, and with me, of course, the indubitable Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this new year?
So far, so good. I haven't embarrassed myself too much in the first 5 days of the year, so that bodes pretty well. I think if you project for the rest of the year, that's pretty good.
You know, yeah.
I think I'm
all about projection on this show.
So right. That's accurate, right? Yeah.
There you go.
That's how it works.
Works for me.
Great.
So we'll jump right into it. We've got there actually we lamented, not in the last show but the one before that, that the Royals kind of being a little sneaky snake in the grass there, just not really doing anything, but felt like they were ready to pounce, and they made some moves. We talked about Kendrys Morales, we talked about Alex Rios, we talked about a lot of the moves the Royals had made in our last show, and then they've made even more since then. First one we're going to talk about, the Royals, obviously the need was starting pitching. We threw out some kind of wishful one, you know, candidates or whatever, and actually one of the names, just kind of the throwaway names that I think we even mentioned in a few shows back, was Edinson Volquez, and how he was somebody who was in a situation that is one that I'm not sure how to exactly phrase this, but he's a person, a player that's in a position where the Royals could get him. That, you know, usually players in his position the Royals can get. Where an up and down rocky career, not many teams want to take a chance, but if you get him in the right situation, does the right things, he can work for him. And you know what? I'm a believer in Dave Island. I mean, he's gotten the most that he absolutely can out of Jeremy Guthrie for the last 2.5 seasons. He's gotten he helped. I mean, James Shields is probably going to be good wherever he goes, but you know, he at least kept him on track, didn't let him fall apart when he could have. Two very good seasons from James Shields. he got. I mean, before Vargas's was it his appendix?
Yep.
Late in the year. I mean, before that, Vargas was going great. You know, yeah. And I attribute a lot of that to Dave Island. I mean, he helped Irvin Santana have a great year. So I mean, it's certainly I believe that, you know, Island is a legit pitching coach worth, you know, what his status is. So to start off, I'll say I like the move. If for nothing, I mean, it's pretty low risk. What was the I'm off. God, I can't remember off the top of my head what the contract figures were, Mike. What do you?
Well, he it's officially a 2-year, $20 million kind of deal. And there's an option year as well.
Of course,
there's an option year.
No Royals contract is complete without an option year.
It really isn't. And so when you look at like the going rate, some of the guys we talked about were Brandon McCarthy and who's the guy who signed the other Dodgers, Brett Anderson.
Yeah.
Both of those guys signed for like $10 million deals. Both of those guys have been very good at times, but they've also both been very injured at times. And, you know, when it kind of settles out that an average starting pitcher's annual salary is going to level out during guy in his, you know, 30s or whatever. I mean, it's the market said, okay, it's going to be about $10 million per year on average. And that's what he got. So the money's not too bad. It's a long-term kind of thing. It's, you know, it's not a great deal. It's not like, you know, signing some guy for $2-5 million and he can pan out and you can do whatever. But, you know, they do have to rely on him to provide something. So if he doesn't, it'll be a disappointment. But it also, you know, again, doesn't cripple you. It's only $7 million this year. There's $9.5 million for the second year. And then there's the guaranteed $3 million buyout if they don't go with the option, which, you know, that's kind of the Royals' way to defer some money down the line so that they don't have to put it to this year's payroll, which is going to be a record high again. So it's not a bad deal. It's he's a very... I don't know. Apologies to Mrs. Volquez, but it's not a sexy acquisition because it's just not. It's just he's been average at times. Last year, he kind of broke out. There's some statistical ideas behind that, that it was being caught by Russell Martin was a big part of it. You know, look at his 2012 through 2013. He wasn't really that great. He gave up a lot of runs, a lot of walks. And that could be an issue. But at the same time, again, like you said, maybe something last year clicked. Maybe he figured something out, made an adjustment, and it wasn't just Russell Martin. Maybe Dave Island saw something that he can work with. You saw what happened when they got Jeremy Guthrie in. Like you said, he went from being pretty much a last chance to being a pretty okay back of the rotation kind of guy, and Dave Island takes a lot of credit for that. So it's... not really replacing Jay Shields, but it's for what was out there and for what money the Royals could use, it's not awful. And I think a lot of people knee-jerk reaction was just that it was awful. And it, you know, it could be. He could go out and walk everybody and still give up a bunch of hits, and you got a problem. But he could continue if he does what he did last year or what he did with the Dodgers in about, you know, five or six, looks like five starts at the end of 2013, you know, that could be okay. You can kind of get around that. And so I'm not really worried about it. They just kind of need him to be a number three kind of starter. And I think he can do, and even number four, if you think Vargas could be the number three, I think he can do that. He can get you almost 200 innings with some upside to be pretty good. So yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah. I mean, he is another pitcher in the mold of Jeremy Guthrie, Jason Vargas. He's a back end of the rotation guy where if you get a good season out of him, like he had last year, then he can be a number three type pitcher. And it's interesting if you look at his FanGraphs page, right? So we've talked before about fielding independent pitching, which basically tries to brush away all the extraneous factors and looks at just what a pitcher controls, how good is he, and basically what his ERA should be. That's kind of normalized for, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but your FIP is normalized for what the league average for like defensive and offensive categories, whatever's into it in the equation, what those league averages are. And then XFIP is kind of like what the league averages should be, is more or less the simpleton's way of explaining it. Is that, am I on the right track?
It's trying to factor out the things that the pitcher can't control. So it normalizes the batting average on balls in play. It considers, you know, the walk percentages and strikeout percentages. And then in XFIP, it's a lot of that has to do with like the home run per fly ball, tries to normalize that too. So to try to say, okay, this is about, it's just trying to nail down how well they actually pitched versus
right.
the ERA. Because, I mean, you can have years where, you know, Volquez is a good example. It's like his time with the Padres, you know, you look at it raw numbers, he got shelled, but his FIP is a lot better than his ERA. So, you know, maybe over that period he was unlucky or maybe he was bad, but a typical pitcher with that type of stat line trying to take the noise out usually has better results.
Yeah, and that's interestingly what I wanted to point out is, so if you look at his FIP for the last 3 years, 2012, 2013, 2014, in 2012 it was 4.06, in 2013 it was 4.24, in 2014 it was 4.15. And then his XFIP in 2012 was 4.2, in 2013 4.07, in 2014 it was 4.2 as well. So pretty consistent in that 4.06 to 4.24 range there for the FIP to XFIP, which, you know, sometimes those can be, you know, decently out of whack because, you know, you might be catching even more bad luck. And then once it's normalized for, you know, what the league average should be or whatever it is, then you know, the numbers become even, you know, they kind of regress towards a mean even more. So there's some consistency there, but year over year it's consistent. But then you look at the ERA, like in 2012 it was 4.14, which is, you know, not terrible, but, you know, just kind of eh. And then 2013 was 5.71, which is like Hochever-esque bad. Yeah. And then, but then last year it was 3.04, right? So point being, when you take away the noise, he's basically been the same pitcher those last 3 years. It's just that, you know, for whatever reason, something, you know, 1 year it worked out really in his favor. 1 year it worked out not in his favor at all. And then 1 year it was just kind of, it was right there. And if you look, a lot of those numbers bear it out. In 2012, which was his kind of average year, he had a 292 BABIP, which was about what you would expect, right? But in his really bad year in 2013, it was 325, which is much higher than you would expect. But then last year, his really good year, it was 263. So, you know, I think one of the things that usually you see, at least that we have seen the last few years with the current Royals organization, with Dave Island as the pitching coach and the environment they're brought into, you know, things like your BABIP, your home run to fly ball ratio, those types of things usually trend down simply because Kauffman is such an unfriendly hitter's park. The Royals have had a very good defense for the last few years. So, you know, it's not a stretch to say that looking at Volquez's numbers, that it could be closer to the good or the average year just based on the trends we've seen recently. So kind of as you said, you know, it's not something that is super sexy, but it's something that you look at and you say, okay, you know, at the end of the year, you might look back and say, you know what, he was a serviceable number three. And over the last 3 years, he's also averaged 180 innings, which is important because at this point, nobody knows Yordan Ventura and Danny Duffy's future in terms of how many innings they can handle or will handle. And that's the big wild card, and that is the linchpin to this whole thing. If the Royals want to repeat any sort of success they had, it's got to rest on their two, hopefully not over-labored shoulders there, because it's, I mean, like, I've heard Jeff Passan on 610. He comes on 610 once a week on Danny Parkin's show. I hear him on my ride home. And often, more than once, he said that, and Jeff Passan, and it's this year now, I believe, sometime in the summer of this year, he's coming out with a book all about pitchers, pitching development, Tommy John surgeries, the prevalence of pitching injuries, why it happens, you know, what's possible solutions there are, which it doesn't really, based on what I've heard him talk about, doesn't really seem like there are any. And that's kind of the scary part, because based on what he knows, and he spent years researching this and talking to lots of experts, and in his estimation, it is not a matter of if Yordan Ventura will ever have to have Tommy John, it's a matter of when. So that's kind of tough to stomach, knowing how important Ventura is. Now, hopefully it's a situation like, you know, maybe Irvin Santana. I mean, Santana's had, you know, kind of a quote-unquote ticking time bomb type thing going on for years, and he's been able to make it work, you know. So, you know, hopefully it doesn't happen for, you know, years down the road, if it does at all. But, you know, there's definitely a lot of risk there, and Danny Duffy has – He's never really shown that he can be healthy for an extended period of time. So I shouldn't say extended period, for an entire season. So it's going to be tough for those two next year, having so much pressure. I mean, they need to stay healthy. But one of the things that's going to help that out is if Volquez pitches well, then you look to, I feel like we keep saying this every year, but, you know, your Sean Manaea's and your Kyle Zimmer's of the world, yeah, that if need be, and if they're ready, they can come up, and then the Royals have some options. And as we all know, options are always a good thing.
Yeah, and it's like when you look at what they had last year, like that when Ventura got hurt that first time when he, you know, strain in his elbow, whatever the flexor.
Real scary.
I don't remember what it was exactly called, but it was an elbow thing, and it's like elbow is bad news. You know, they had to start Aaron Brooks, and that, you know, go well, to say the least. This year, I mean, they've got guys like Brian Flint in the Aaron Crow trade, who's perfectly reasonable. They've got You know, Aaron Brooks again is another guy that could possibly be, you know, a decent guy. I mean, you know, they've got, you know, maybe Don Lamb could be somebody like that, or, you know, it just depends. It seems like they have more options. Johan Pino is the other guy that they kind of signed the deal before all this other stuff. And so they have guys who can come in and give you replacement level innings. And that's something that the Royals didn't necessarily really have last year that they do this time. That, you know, it's, again, it's not really fun. I mean, it's not, man, thank God we got Brian Flynn in the fold. But, you know, if someone goes down, you have somebody who can fill in. But, you know, you're looking for right now is this Royals team is going to have to replace what James Shields brought him, which he was good for most of the year, covered a lot of innings. And
as always,
right. And, you know, but Duffy and Ventura pitched better than any other starters on this team. So they have to A, those kind of innings, but also kind of performance. And so that's the key to the season, I think, is what those two do. If they repeat, I think it can be okay. If they don't or they get hurt, it's going to be really rough. I mean, the Royals probably about a 500 team if either of those get hurt. If not, who knows, they could be up there in the 89 wins like last year. They could be 91, 92 if they get lucky. Who knows? Maybe he wakes up at the plate and it goes really, really well. But I don't know. I mean, Jim Vargas and Jeremy Guthrie and Edinson Volquez are not going to staff. They're going to be fine complementary pieces. But the Royals need those guys to step up. And right now it's Ventura and it's Duffy. And, you know, maybe you won't get 200 innings out of them. But honestly, with that bullpen, if you get 180 innings out of either of them or both of them, you can probably get around that. You can do that. So, I think that's the big key for this year. Because the Royals have shown that, you know, they can win with a pretty bleh Hosmer season and a really bad and a rough Infante season and et cetera, et cetera. Because nobody hit that well last year, really.
No.
So
nobody at all. I mean, Butler had his worst season as a pro. Moustakas, you already talked about. I mean, Infante had a terrible season. Yeah. And I mean, that's one bright spot, I guess, if you just to talk about, if you want to talk about offense, which we're not going to get into in depth, but I mean, Infante, nowhere to go but up. And to kind of piggyback on your thought of, well, if everything blows up, they could be an 80-win team, but they could be an 89-90-win team. I mean, I feel like the last 2 years and then this year, it's basically the same. They've been an 85-win team, and last year they outperformed the 85-win team. The year before, they were pretty much right there. So, I mean, I think they're an 85-win team again this year, but just as we all know from baseball, they can outperform that, and they could win 90-plus games, but they could also underperform and win 79. So hopefully it's not the latter, but, you know, it's certainly possible, and a lot of it hinges on this. But one of the things we talked about is having options, and not only do the Royals have more options this year, but what we're going to talk about next is the Royals jumping, going out and getting even more options, sort of.
Right.
The Royals went out and signed Chris Medlin to a very, very team-friendly kind of Mike and I were talking about it over before the show, going over everything we were going to talk about, and I described it as a lottery ticket, you know, basically. I mean, I think it's like a, what is it, two-year, $5 million contract for Medlin, what was I can't
it's
remember.
2 years and $8.5 million total.
8.5.
Yeah.
Okay.
And with a mutual option. Yeah, and there are incentives. I don't remember what the incentives are exactly, but they're always going to be like games pitched and innings pitched. They're never tied to actual like performance results. It's like a union thing, I think. But yeah, Medlin, when the Royals signed Morales, people lost it. When they signed Rios, people didn't like that. When they signed Volquez, people were at least underwhelmed, is maybe the kindest way to put it. But when they got Medlin, like, that was almost universally praised, because Medlin, when he's been healthy, is really, really good. Like, his numbers basically all the time with the Braves had been really, really good. And it's just a matter of you know, he's had two Tommy John surgeries. And so that's where the you know, it's a risk. The Royals could completely just be paying him to sit in the trainer's room. But, you know, they've had decent success with Tommy John guys and projects like this. And if he gives them anything even close to what he gave the Braves over the last 2 years he was active, man, that's a heck of a help, especially with Ventura and Duffy. I mean, you're talking about a Chris Medlin in his prime. I mean, I guess he's not going to be in his prime, but if he can be anywhere close to, you know, what he was in 2013, he threw 197 innings, had a 3.11 ERA. And we talked about FIP. He had 3.48 there. Didn't hardly walk anybody. Didn't give up a lot of homers. Just solid. Like, I mean, a solid guy. He's got a good strikeout to walk ratio all the time. That's pretty great. I mean,
the year before that, I mean, he only pitched, you know, three quarters of a season, but he was even better.
Yeah, they used him as kind of like a hybrid reliever and starter. I think he started later in the year because that was when he was coming off of his first Tommy John surgery. So, I mean, if you look at what he did after one Tommy John surgery, he was a lot better after his first Tommy John surgery than he was before it. So, I mean, I'm not saying he's going to be better now after the second, because pitchers generally aren't.
Yeah.
The track record is not good for those guys because, I mean, your arm has blown up twice. But
now, just to, if I may interject,
yeah.
Something usually what you worry about a lot with Tommy John's, especially the second surgery, is a loss in velocity. But I mean, if you look at looking at Fangraphs here, his fastball velocity numbers, I mean, his highest that he was averaging per season was 91.1 miles per hour in 2011, and in 2013, when he had a really good year, it was only 89.4 miles per hour. So, you know, from that aspect, he isn't a guy that he's not a Yordano Ventura who's relying on overpowering mm-hmm. stuff. And if he loses 5 miles an hour on his fastball, he's not going to know what to do. So he's already, you know, kind of in that mold of having to, what's the term, like in football, all the like white guy receivers, you know, like crafty veteran. I mean, maybe that's just it,
yeah,
but he's that kind of a guy, like a Jamie Moyer, you know, who can, so that's a positive that it doesn't really appear that he's relied too much mm-hmm. on overpowering stuff, especially when you consider in 2013, he only threw his fastball 55% of the time. Whereas, you know, if you pull up your Donald Ventura's numbers, that's going to be quite a bit higher.
Like 75 probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean,
sorry to interrupt, but I thought that was interesting.
No, I think you're right, Trek. You know, if you take a pitcher who gets by on that kind of velocity and you take it away, well, that's a big part, like not just in the big leagues, like every step of the way, usually that guy has made it to where he was based on that velocity. So now you almost have to like relearn everything. Frank Tanana was the guy in the 80s who was like 98, 99 miles an hour guy, had surgery and came back and was throwing like 89. He had to completely relearn how to pitch because it's a lot different when you're throwing 89, 89. So Madsen has always had good control. He's been able to get strikeouts, you know, regardless of how hard he throws. So if he's healthy, that could be pretty solid. They kind of expect him, I think, about June is when you'd see him. You know, and that might even be best case. But, you know, if you're looking at it in June, that's not a bad time to get him. You know, use him as kind of, use him as a reliever for a couple innings here and there. Use him to kind of help, you know, take away some innings from Ventura or Duffy, kind of piggyback him sometimes if you need to. You know, I think that'd be really, really useful. And then if he holds up on that, man, you got a heck of a guy for 2016 to kind of be in there full time. And so that's the exciting thing about Medlin. And plus, they're not really paying him anything. I mean,
no,
they're not paying him unless he does something good. And so,
and even then, it's still not much.
Yeah, it's not that much. It's
if he performs at the level that he did, like you were saying previously, I mean, he's going to be severely underpaid. And then you have a couple things. Like, first of all, awesome, because then you have a, you know, a very good pitcher on the staff. Mm-hmm. But second, you know, we always talk about options, and you know, whether it's 2015 or 2016, it probably wouldn't be 2015, but 2016, you know, if you're looking into the trade deadline and you need a piece and you've got, you know, Sean Manaea and Kyle Zimmer, who, God willing, should be, if not already in the majors, ready to go by 2016, you know, and Ventura and Duffy are still rolling, and you've still got Guthrie and Volquez and them, you know, on the team, then you've got a really, really nice trade chip, because you've got a workable contract, a good pitcher, somebody that can, you know, somebody's going to need somebody like that. So, you know, I mean, if you ask me, it's just an all-around really solid move by the Royals, because they might lose a few million dollars if he gives them nothing, but they could gain a whole hell of a lot if he gives them something. So that I like it. And just for grins, I looked up Ventura's numbers. He threw his fastball 65% of the time, so 20% more often than Medlin did in Medlin's last full season. And his average velocity was 97 miles an hour, according to Fangraphs now. So, yeah, good Lord. But his changeup, let's look at this. His changeup, average velocity 87.5 miles per hour, and Medlin's fastball in 2013 was averaging 89. So if that tells you anything,
that's just crazy.
Yeah. So with that, I think that pretty much wraps up the major moves. Mike, I'll let you kind of hit on some of the smaller stuff that the Royals have done to kind of wrap up this section.
Yeah, they did. I mean, yesterday, or was it yesterday? Yeah, it was yesterday, I think. They signed Ryan Madsen to a minor league deal, which is, again, another one of those things where, who, you know, zero risk. I mean, it's a minor league deal. If he does well, great. If he doesn't, they're not out anything. Madsen was an elite setup guy with the Phillies for about 5 years. Like, just solid. Like, great strikeout numbers, pretty good control numbers, was really tough to hit, didn't give up homers. He's the kind of guy that would fit in very, very well with the Royals. The problem is he hasn't pitched since 2011 in the big leagues because of injuries. I think he spent a couple of seasons with teams on their dime just recovering because thought maybe he could come back, and he didn't. So that's something, you know, you talk about Medlin and being just, you know, hardly any risk and you're not out much. Madsen's even better. I mean, if he doesn't make the team out of spring training, fine. I mean, it's not any loss, but if he does and he's healthy, well, shoot, you've got a bullpen of Greg Holland, Wade Davis, Kelvin Herrera, Jason Fraser, Ryan Madsen. That's
Brandon Finnegan,
Luke Hochaver. Yeah. I mean, this is, that's
the best arguably the best bullpen in baseball.
That's better. Really, really good. Yeah. So, and that's not even with, like, Tim Collins and Lewis Coleman are both still out there. And I think of them could be better. I mean, Coleman was kind of lost last year. I don't know what happened, but he's been good every other time. So,
And beyond that, I mean, we keep talking about Manaea and Zimmer. I mean, if it gets to the point where they're ready and, the starting five are rolling and there's no spot for them. I mean, the Royals showed last year with Finnegan, they won't hesitate to bring him up and let them roll in the bullpen, just get some major league experience and throw him in. You know, I mean,
it's the Earl Weaver way. So
yeah, I mean,
it's how Saberhagen and Gubazon and Danny Jackson came up too. So
I have never thought that that's a bad idea, you know, get them in there, let them get their feet wet and in hopefully low pressure situations. You know, I mean, I think that honestly is what helped Finnegan a lot. Like, you know, I think being in the College World Series that same year helped a little bit, but also, I mean, he came in first, his first couple times were pretty low pressure situations. They really, and I mean, he'll be in the starting mix next year, 'cause I think they're going to give him a chance to be a starter like he was in college. So, mm-hmm. I mean, but he's another player that, you know, I will give the Royals credit. I think, you know, regardless of what he ends up being, I think he's going to be good in some role. And I think the Royals did right by him in terms of how they kind of brought him along. So. Yeah,
they identified who could clearly handle that kind of move and just went with it. They were just aggressive with it. So I think that's all right. Some of the other minor things, of course, if you're going to sign all these guys, that meant that Carlos Puguero ended up being released, so he is gone. Ryan Jackson was a shortstop, spent maybe a month and a half in the Royals organization. He was designated for assignment. But the big name was Johnny Giovitella got designated for assignment to make room for Medlin. And then the next day was traded to the Angels for Brian Broderick. So, you know, we've talked about Giovitella a lot on this show as a prospect, as Chris gets his whipping boy, whatever. And I hope it's an opportunity in L.A. I still think he can hit at this level. I think his glove is better than I think he, you know, I think he can still do it. But, you know, he still has to go do
it. Remains to be seen.
Right. I mean, he still has to prove it. But even with Christian Colon ahead of him, with Omar Infante ahead of him, and pretty clearly it was time for a change of scenery news to him, because Chris Getz is in the Royals front office now. So I just keep calling Getz, and he's like, Chris, it's time. And Chris just fist pumps and goes and does it. The blonde kid from Karate Kid. That's what he strikes me as.
Oh, Lord. Like the bully kid?
Oh, yeah.
Sweep the leg
the
guy?
Sweep the leg kid, yeah. That's just
or
what
the
he...
guy at the end goes over and goes, sweep the leg.
Yeah. That's just like, that's what he would do. Like, he would just, like, I don't know. Airbox down the hallways. I don't
that
know.
Totally, that sounds exactly right. So with that, I think we're gonna take our first break, and then we're gonna come back and we're gonna hit on everybody's favorite topic this time of year, and that is Hall of Fame discussion. So stick with us, and we'll be back to talk some hot, spicy Hall of Fame action back on the other side.
So look, you've got a ton of places in Kansas City that you can go to, and I wrote out this elaborate script that was going to convince you all why you needed to go to Kelly's, but then I thought, it doesn't need to be that complicated. What do you want? You want a good night out with friends. You want cheap drinks. You want good food. What can be better than beer and pizza? You've got Joe's in the back. You've got drink specials every night. And if you're not at Arrowhead tailgating, you got the Chiefs on Sundays. So tell me, what can be better than that? You need flashing lights? No, you don't need that. You don't need to spend $70 on a night out to impress a date? No. You go out to where the bartenders are going to recognize you every time you show up, in an old building that has a lot of character in a great district of Kansas City. It's that simple. Don't overthink it. Just go to Kelly's Westport Inn.
Welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. Thanks for sticking with us through that break. We really appreciate it. And as I mentioned before we went to break, we're going to talk about everybody's favorite January topic. You guessed it, Hall of Fame. So, I mean, where we're at is all the Hall of Fame ballots have gone out. All the people have turned in their votes. And every year, it basically usually boils down to your old school versus your new school. Your scout to the, if we're talking in the context of the movie version of Moneyball, your old guy with the freaking hearing aids and thick Copapa glasses scout guys, or the Clint Eastwood how to hit the curve, whatever the hell that stupid movie was, versus your Billy Beane Moneyball types. You know, that's a lot of times that's what it comes down to. Usually MVP discussions and Hall of Fame discussions fall along those lines. But in the midst of that, you get sports writers, baseball writers on both sides of those grandstanding for whichever side that they're on, you know, like, oh, this is what the Hall of Fame's all about. And oh, this is what it's actually about. And this is dumb and you're dumb and that's stupid and stop saying that. And, you know, whatever the hell else it gets to. So why not bring it into the podcast sector and have Mike and I give our just hot Sprott's takes on this Hall of Fame stuff, because that's what this show is all about. So as we get started, I mean, Mike, just lay it down for me. When I say Baseball Hall of Fame, what's your initial thought about just Baseball Hall of Fame, the process in general?
So the Hall of Fame gets voted on by the BBWAA, and mostly that's national writers, mostly that's beat writers. But in a lot of cases, there's also guys who haven't covered baseball in years. And there's a lot of members of the BBWAA who have covered baseball for a while and do so regularly, but they don't have a vote in the Hall of Fame. So that's kind of a weird part of it to me. The main thing, though, that I don't like is that there's always been a limit on the number of players you can vote for. There's up to 10 is what it is. And I don't expect every year for 10 guys to get voted in. But the problem is that you've got guys who have to have 5% or better to remain on the ballot. And so what ends up happening a lot of times, I think people have to make decisions on which players to vote for and which ones not to vote for based on the process and not on the players necessarily. So that's my first problem kind of with the whole thing. And so someone like Craig Biggio last year was two votes short of getting the 75% necessary to get elected. Two of those votes could have been guys who voted to keep Don Mattingly on the ballot for another year. He's on his final year of the ballot now. So, and he's not going to make the Hall of Fame. He got 8.2% of the vote last year. He's not going to make the Hall of Fame. There was no need to keep him on the ballot because he's not going to get elected. So if someone like Craig Biggio didn't make the Hall of Fame, clearly he's in the right range to be a Hall of Famer. 3,000 hits, you know, a great player at three different positions. There's no reason for him to not be in the Hall of Fame other than the procedure to vote for him. If you ask most people, and nearly three-fourths of those writers have said, yes, he's a Hall of Famer. You know, if you made it a yes-no, a binary ballot, he would have been in probably last year or the year before pretty easily. And what you've got now is you have guys like Mark McGwire, Larry Walker, some of those fringe guys, along with Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, Tim Raines, you know, guys who Tim Raines isn't a good one to lump in there, but Clemens and Bonds and even like Jeff Bagwell, guys who have that kind of the steroid thing going on with them. You know, those are pretty important guys who I think should probably get into the Hall of Fame, but they could have easily been in earlier than this. Now, the steroids guys, I kind of get why they're not in necessarily, but somebody like Biggio could have been in. Now, that's one of 10 votes for somebody who's voting on the Hall of Fame. You know, some of the Tim Raines probably should have been in a long time ago. That's another one out of 10 votes that somebody has to put in now. And so what you get now is you get guys like Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, John Smoltz. Those guys are, I think all three of those are going to get in. Gary Sheffield has somewhat of a case. Nomar Garciaparra kind of has a case. But then guys like Jeff Kent, Larry Walker, Edgar Martinez, Curt Schilling, those are kind of fringy guys who deserve to, you know, have a shot. Mike Piazza got 62% last year. So there's just a ton of people who are popping up that really should probably get in there. And it doesn't look like it's going to clear up all that soon, especially if some of these guys aren't getting elected. Because, I mean, like let's say best case Biggio, Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, John Smoltz. Let's say those four get in. Well, you still got Piazza, Bagwell, Raines, Clemens, Bonds, Schilling, Martinez, Mike Mussina, Jeff Kent, Larry Walker, Mark McGwire. Arguably, any of those guys are valid, and you're not going to get a vote for all 10 of them on anybody's ballot because there's only 10 allowed. So that's kind of an issue too. But I've also always had a problem with the way that guys hang on. Like, you know, Mattingly is okay. You know, why is he still on the ballot? He's not going to make it. But then you also have guys in the past like Burt Blyleven and Jim Rice and some of these guys who are on the ballot. It used to be 15 years. Now it's 10 years. So they'd be in their 12th, 13th, 14th year. And maybe that's when they start to make it. And so that's also not like the writers are voting in 10 guys and they're just getting squeezed out. It's that there are one, two, maybe three guys getting voted in over that period. And the writers are making conscious decisions right then that they're not going to vote that guy in. It's obvious that guys, that these writers aren't using their full ballot, even though they can, of 10 guys. So they're intentionally leaving those guys off for years and years and years. And then you see where, like, you know, Blylevin climbs up and ends up making it, and Jim Rice climbs up and ends up making it, and Jack Morris climbs up and nearly made it. But I think at a certain point, you kind of get an idea, like, is this guy a Hall of Famer? Yes or no? And you kind of know it when you see it. So that's my biggest problem with the process. And this year, it seems like the discussion of the process has been a bigger discussion than the actual players involved. Like, it hasn't really been about the Bonds, Clemens, steroid stuff. It's been mostly about, you know, how many people you can vote for. So that's making this year particularly interesting and kind of annoying, because, you know, you want to talk about the players more than the way they get voted in. But, I mean, that's my biggest problem, is that the ballot itself really sets up for a lot of weird problems that don't seem to make sense with what you want to do for the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, you know, and I'm a big proponent of your the way you put it, I like the way you put it, a binary question. You know, someone either is a Hall of Famer or they're not. You know, I don't and just something that I was kind of thinking about when, as you were talking, if you're gonna have a limit of 10 or whatever, then, you know, I think you should kind of tweak the system. Where, because I too don't like the kind of just people just hanging around until they get in. You know, it's like, well, you know, what made someone more worthy 10 years after their first initial ballot? You know, and they're like you're talking about this logjam of players that are all kind of borderline worthy, whatever. And so if you're in a situation like that, then I'm okay with, okay, we have a cap of, you know, 10 players that can get in or whatever. And so 10 players got in the Hall of Fame this year. So everybody who didn't make it and got a certain percentage of votes can be on the ballot next year. But then you should have a scenario where the reverse is also true. So if two people only make it and all these other people, you know, that were on the ballot didn't make it and they were open available spots, then they should go off the ballot. And then and that's kind of the way it is with the NFL, where I believe it's 5 years. Like, Derek Thomas got in on his last year. And if you don't make it within the first 5 years, then I believe it's 10 years later, then you come up again as part of a veterans committee. And then the veterans committee looks back and says, okay, maybe we overlooked something, you know, and I really like that system. You look at Emmett Thomas for the Chiefs. He got in the Hall of Fame, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And, you know, he played on the Super Bowl team back in the 60s. So he was out of it for a while, had his chance to get in, missed it, and then come back up. And I think this was even his second time around on a veterans committee. And, you know, I don't think it's just like, hey, everybody's in the pot. You know, I think people are kind of optioned and say, hey, look at this guy again, because I think it warrants consideration. So, you know, I think that system makes a lot more sense. And, you know, maybe baseball has something similar, because, to be honest with you, I don't pay too much attention to the particulars.
It'll just drive you mad.
The voting over the years, just because it's balderdash. So
they do have a veterans committee and different committees, but it's basically like you can vote for up to four, and you still have to get that 75% threshold. So a lot of times you don't get in there. I think guys like Ron Santo was one of the last guys to get voted in by the veterans committee. And they'll also have like expansion era committees and things like that, you know, but yeah, it seems like it's even more difficult to get voted in. It's Joe Posnanski did a kind of interesting experiment where one week he sent out a survey. And it was like, you can vote for four of these guys. He basically gave them the Veterans Committee ballot. And then he gave them a binary ballot, a yes, no. And when he gave them the Veterans Committee ballot, it was like, I think two people got in. It was like Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, or maybe Biggio. And when he sent the other one, it was like five guys got in, and it was all, you know, reasonable. It was like people who seemed like, yeah, they should be in. You know, there weren't any like weird, oh, well, I can vote yes, so I'll vote yes. You know, it was like the sample size that he got of his readers worked out to where, you know, any guys trying to screw around with it, you know, were pretty much not able to do so because it was a big enough sample. So, you know, I think that shows what probably ought to happen. And that's really what it always kind of should be. Because, I mean, I think it's like you kind of know when you know. I mean, there's if a guy to an extent, and for as statistical as I like to be sometimes, sometimes it just comes down to if you have to ask the question, is that guy a Hall of Famer? Your answer is probably no. So, like, Lee Smith is on the ballot. He got 29.9%. Is Lee Smith a Hall of Famer? Well, I don't know. So, he's probably not. Alan Trammell probably has a good case, and probably underrated, frankly. Well, but, you know, like just I just don't
know. A hometown example of Frank White, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the All-Star games, the Gold Gloves, you know, the great moments he had, but is he really a Hall of Famer? No, he's probably that next tier down, to be completely honest. You know, no shame in that at all. Absolutely not. No, but you know, at the same time, it's like there is that component of knowing, you know, when you see it. And so I think that's why your idea of the binary thing makes so much more sense, you know, like, because if you put, and I think the steroids thing has made it even worse too, because, you know, besides just the politics of it, like if you put, say,
wasn't in it, Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds would have been first ballot.
Yeah. And so, but now you've got all this backlog of Mark McGwire, Rafael Palmeiro, Sammy Sosa, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, all these guys that, you know, would have been staggered in their inductions into the Hall of Fame have now all been pushed together and they're all in the same category. But then, you know, and he's obviously not retired yet, but one of the names we were kicking around earlier today when we were talking about this over email is Carlos Beltran. Like, if you look career stats-wise, I mean, Carlos Beltran has a legitimate case to be a Hall of Famer. I would vote him in. Now, I obviously don't have a vote, nowhere near close, so that's a, that's a moot point. But the point is, you can vote him in, but when you look at a ballot and you say, okay, am I going to vote in Carlos Beltran? Well, I've still got, you know, there's Mark McGwire's on my ballot, and Rafael Palmeiro's here, and Barry Bonds is here, and Roger Clemens is here, and I would put Beltran in. We'll stick with Bonds and Clemens, because I would put Beltran in over McGwire, and Palmeiro's a little bit different.
Oh, Palmeiro's not on the ballot because
he's not? He's
steroids.
Did he, like, he's off the ballot?
He didn't make it, yeah. He was the only guy on the ballot who admitted it while he was on the ballot or something. I don't remember.
Oh, huh.
But I mean, he didn't make it last year. He could have.
I guess I didn't realize. Like I said, I don't pay as much attention as just because it.
No, it's I think he would have warranted staying on for consideration for that whole thing. But
I mean, how many? He had 500 home runs, right? Like, how many 500 home run hitters are not in the Hall of Fame? You know what I mean?
It might be McGwire. Yeah,
are probably the only ones right now. And so you know, that used to be in just an auto boom. Right. You're in.
Yep.
And so, you know, I mean, what's the difference between Eddie Murray and Rafael Palmeiro? Not a huge, because Eddie Murray's in the Hall of Fame, right? I mean, not a huge difference there. So, at least in my, maybe I'm underestimating how good Eddie Murray was, because he was kind of before my time, but
he was
regardless.
But yeah.
regardless, you, so if you're sitting there with Carlos Beltran and you, and you're given a yes-no question, is Carlos Beltran a Hall of Famer? You might say, yes, he's a Hall of Famer. But then if you look and you say, okay, I've got this ballot, and I've got to vote Carlos Beltran versus Mark McGwire versus Barry Bonds versus Roger Clemens versus all these guys, it's like, well, I'm not going to vote yes on Clemens and Bonds and McGuire for a separate issue because I think they took steroids. You know, this is me.
Oh, they totally did.
Yeah, and this is me speaking as a hypothetical baseball writer with a vote. You know, who's standing on principle and says I'm not going to vote those three in because I think they took steroids. Yes, exactly. we'll pretend I'm John Heyman right now. but so then, just from a mentality standpoint, you look at it and you say, okay, well, I can't vote Carlos Beltran in and not vote in Barry Bonds because Barry Bonds was clearly better than Carlos Beltran. No slight against Beltran. Bonds is better than everybody.
Pretty much.
I mean, like, there's not a single player on the ballot now who you would say was better than Barry Bonds. And I don't even know there's anybody playing right now that you could say.
I don't think there's anybody that's in the hall who's better than Barry Bonds.
Yeah, I mean, he has
he
has a legitimate claim as possibly the best baseball player to ever live, just on pure talent and production and everything. And the thing that angers me, the reason, like, if I truly did have a vote, the reason I would vote Barry Bonds in is because Bonds was a Hall of Famer without steroids.
Yeah.
Now, the reason I kind of stuttered on Mark McGuire earlier is because I don't have confidence that McGuire was a Hall of Famer without steroids. I think he would have been that next tier. You know, I think that steroids did give him enough to push him over that edge and make him that player. So that's why I kind of hesitate on McGuire. But Clemens and Bonds, 100%, they were Hall of Famers without steroids. They were Hall of Famers with them. Who cares? You know, put them in. But you want to stand on your principles, that's fine. But I think from a mentality standpoint, it kind of mucks things up because then you do have to make that decision. Do you say, am I going to put Carlos Beltran in the Hall of Fame over Barry Bonds? Even though those are two completely separate scenarios, because it should be asked, is Carlos Beltran a Hall of Famer? Is Barry Bonds a Hall of Famer? You know, so that is it. That makes the whole process so much murkier, and it makes it frustrating to even try and follow it. Because it's just annoying, and then you have people that my possibly most annoying kind of idea behind Hall of Fame voting is, I mean, you will legitimately have people out there that have the nobody's a first ballot Hall of Famer type attitude, where it's like, what does that even mean? You know, like, it shouldn't have anything, and you hear it just like you announcers on when they're in a game, you know, and somebody's close to retirement. You heard it so much with Tony Gonzalez, just to have a close example, you know, for the NFL, for the Chiefs, you know, oh, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer. Who gives a crap if it's first ballot? Like, it shouldn't matter. It should be he's a Hall of Famer, you know, and if it's not, I mean, I suppose there could be a scenario where you would have somebody that was so unlucky that the first two or three years they were eligible, there were legitimately 10 candidates that were more deserving than them, and that's why they didn't make it. I mean, I suppose that's possible, but just based on history, we know, you know, not that many people get elected into the Hall of Fame every year. If you're a Hall of Famer, you should get in within those first few years. So, you know, I definitely think it's more of a is he or isn't he type of thing. And, you know, like you said, if you have to ask the question, I mean, obviously, we say if you have to ask the question, then he's probably not. But our whole basis is that we should send out ballots where they ask the question if he should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's kind of different context. You know, if you have to ask yourself.
Is
he a Hall of Fame caliber player? You know, like if you're in a bar just having drinks with somebody and they say, oh, hey, is Carlos Beltran a Hall of Famer? And you say, yes, you know, then that means he should get your vote. But, you know, if someone says, is he a Hall of Famer? And you say, oh man, I don't know. You know, then it's no, the answer is no. You know, it's quite simple.
Yeah.
So now, I mean, like we said, there is a place for the Veterans Committee type thing where you say, okay, there are some people that might've been overlooked. And actually Carlos Beltran is a good example of that as well, because his era, when he was really kind of in his prime, was still kind of the tail end of the steroid era. And there was all the Barry Bonds stuff when he was, you know, having his best years. There was Roger Clemens was getting a lot of media attention. You know, you had Alex Rodriguez who was going crazy, and he was on, even though nobody knew it at that time, but we know it now that he was on steroids and all this stuff. So he he kind of got overshadowed by a lot of stuff. So that's actually a good case of there are scenarios where that is the case. But the majority of the time, Ken Griffey Jr., is he a Hall of Famer? Boom. You knew it the second he walked on the diamond.
He really was
a Hall of Famer. I mean, it was just, there was no doubt, man. I mean, Mike and I, people of our generation, I mean, he was the shit, man. He
Griffey
was the guy,
was
you know?
The man, yes, absolutely.
I mean, I would sit out in my backyard and try and emulate his batting stance, the way he like rocked back and forth and the way he laid his bat. I mean, it was just like, he was, the Michael Jordan of baseball at the time.
Yep.
And I mean, that's the way it went. So I don't know. Some interesting thoughts. It'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. I don't think any of those steroid guys are going to get in again.
No,
I think the guys you said that are pretty good. Like your Pedro Martinez, I think he's a lock.
There's some guys like,
I will lose all faith.
Yeah.
Any Hall of Fame notion of anything. If Pedro Martinez is not a Hall of Fame, I mean, he's about as much of a slam dunk as you can get, because he had.
The only thing I could see someone knocking him for is his innings pitched, because it's low ish, but my goodness, man.
He had a 5-year run, unlike any.
Pedro's peak was better than Koufax, better than so many other guys. I mean, peak Pedro is like, if you have one game for the, to protect your life, it's probably who I pick.
I mean, people talk about Jack Morris, right? So he, Jack Morris had, I think I counted 6 seasons of 4.0 ERA or higher.
Yeah.
Pedro Martinez had only four seasons of an ERA over 3. I mean, the dude had.
That's stupid.
I know. You look at, okay. Like, I just pulled up his page, starting with his time at the Expos through his time with the Red Sox, right? Of starting in 1997 to 2004.
And the thing is, what did he do? What was happening in that period of time?
That was the steroid era. Like, the most offensive era in history, right? So starting in 97, we'll start with his innings pitched, right?
Oh, my God.
In 97, it was 241, 98, 233, 99, 213, 2000, 217. 2001, he was injured, 116. 2002, 199. 2003, 186. And 2004, 217. So only 3 years out of 8 that he didn't pitch over 200 innings. Then those ERAs are just insane from those years. So you look at 97, 1.9, 98, 2.89, 99, 2.07, 2000, 1.74, 2000, 1.74 in 217 innings pitched.
That's
217.
So stupid.
That's insane. He had an 11.78 strikeout per 9 in that season. Like, that has to be like the greatest season. And I've heard people talk about that as possibly the greatest pitching season ever. That's, I mean, he only won 18 games, but we all know pitcher wins are worthless. Like,
right.
what the hell
happened in the games he didn't win?
Yeah, he's 18-6. Like, first of all, how did he not win every game? But how did he lose 6 of them? So, I mean, just the no decisions. I mean, he still had 5 no decisions because he started 29 games. But anyway, in 2001, 2.39 ERA, 2002, 2.26, 2003, 2.22, and 2004, 3.9, which was by far the worst of all those. Almost a full run worse than any of those years. And it was 3.9 in 2004, right in the kind of the steroid era was starting
hot
to
get down
a little bit. But, I mean, good Lord. I mean,
yeah.
From 98 to 2000 was, I mean, 98 was when McGuire broke the record, and 2001 was when Bonds rebroke it. So in those 4 years, Martinez never had anything above 2.89 as far as an ERA is concerned. And his highest FIP in that time was 3.4. So it wasn't just like magic of defense and park. He was pitching in freaking Fenway, for crying out loud. So it definitely wasn't a park factor. Mm-hmm. But so that was a bit of a tangent there, which never happens on this show.
Yeah.
But yeah, I will lose all faith in all things baseball. Pedro Martinez is not a slam dunk Hall of Famer, because he just is.
He is. If he's not a first ballot Hall of Famer, I don't know what they look like.
Nobody is.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And like, Randy Johnson should be in there too. Biggio.
Oh, yeah. We could go back and look at Randy Johnson. We won't, because this is too big of a tangent already. But
go
back and look at Randy Johnson, and it would be nearly very similar.
Same
for the
thing.
Same time.
And probably I think he has a record for 300 strikeout seasons. I'm pretty sure.
Well, how many strikeouts did he have, Tony? Like 5,000 or something ridiculous? I mean, he had a
really close. Yeah. I mean, he just didn't pitch as long as Nolan Ryan. If he had, he would have definitely done it. Yeah. 48-75 on the strikeouts.
Yeah. And from that same time frame of 97 to 2004, I won't go each year, but he had one season where he was injured and pitched 114 innings. Every other year, he pitched no less than 213 innings and a tie of 260. The year he pitched 260 innings, he had a 2.32 ERA. So, again, won't go too much further into that, but good Lord.
There also, fun fact on Randy Johnson, I'm looking at his baseball reference. He actually played in left field at one point in a game.
Look at that. There you go.
So,
see? Versatile is what that is.
He has the most strikeouts by a former left fielder ever.
Bam, there it is. okay, so that'll wrap up the Hall of Fame discussion. And, you know, we're not even going to take a break. We're just going to roll into it. I talked at the beginning of the show about we're going to try something new. So since it's the Royals off season, and maybe we'll even carry this into the season when it gets going. Who knows? We'll have to see how it goes. But since it's the off season and there's not a ton of baseball stuff to talk about, we're going to discuss a little some pop culture stuff.
Just some TV. We're just going to wing it.
And whatever. Something that Mike and I have discussed that we talked about. So, funny story, okay? I'm a big TV guy. For those that follow me on Twitter, probably know I tweet about TV a lot. I follow a lot of TV critics, right? Just eat that shit up. Anyway, a lot of TV critics started tweeting about this show called Black Mirror. And so I'm like, okay, I don't know what this is about, but it's some British show that became available on Netflix. And so all the critics were like, man, it's a great show. It's like a modern day Twilight Zone about technology and that kind of how it, you know, affects society and all this kind of stuff. So I'm like, huh, that might be interesting. But I don't know if my wife will be into it. So, you know, I'll just kind of lay low and see if I can read a little bit more and see what happens. And then, you know, a few days later, my wife comes home from work and she says, hey, somebody at work told me about this show called Black Mirror. Have you heard of this? And I'm like, yeah, I have. You know, I didn't know if you'd be into it or not. So, because I don't know. I know very little about it other than the premise. And she's like, yeah, I heard it's, you know, every show is self-contained. It's a new plot, kind of like The Twilight Zone or Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And she loves Alfred Hitchcock Presents and all that. So we're like, bam, let's do this, right? So we fire up Netflix and it was just like, I think jarring is the word to describe it. I'm not going to spoil what happens, but should I even give the details of the plot? Not what happens, but just the premise.
It's
because, I mean,
I don't know. Because, I mean,
are we a kid friendly show? I don't know.
No, we're not a kid friendly show. Are you kidding? We had fake Ned on this show for years.
That's
so.
A good point.
No, I mean, the basic premise is, I'll spoil it if you don't want to. So, or not, I won't spoil
I'll
it.
I'll spoil it. I just don't know. I just, the more of the appropriateness was.
Oh, no, I think we're good.
Okay, so as the premise goes, this is, you find this out within the first 5 minutes of the show. So I'm not really spoiling anything. But the Prime Minister of England, this is a British TV show, is woken up in the middle of the night by a phone call. Something crazy's happened. He gets called into what I assume is the British Parliament's version of the war room, right? Maybe not. I don't know. Guy's in his robe, whatever. So he rolls in there, and there's this video, and they're playing. This is like the you know, British Secret Service, MI6, whatever. They're playing this for him, and he's watching it, and it's the princess, the queen's daughter. Right, she's tied up and she's being forced to read something to the camera, and she reads that she's been kidnapped, blah blah blah, the only way she'll be set free is is if the Prime Minister of England has sex with a live pig on air at 4 o'clock that day. Right, so like, then all it's like, what is this real? What's going on? And then they're like, the Secret Service people are like, yeah, we've confirmed that she's missing. The agents that were with her were found drugged and everything's gone. You know, she's gone. No one can find her. Like, what about this video? Where is it from? Like, we don't know. You know, he's like, well, what are we going to do? And they're like, they're kind of all looking around like, well, you're going to have to do this, man. And he's like, no, no, no. They're like, well, we're going to try and do everything we can to make sure you don't have to do this. And so the whole show revolves around this. And it's just like, whoa.
That's your introduction to the show.
Yeah. This isn't like I just popped into an episode. This is episode one of the first season of this series, the first 10 minutes of the show. And so I'm just kind of like, whoa, what is going on here? And it's just like, the show does a good job of this part of it where, like, the whole time you're just uncomfortable, right? Just yeah. Freakishly uncomfortable. And that's what the show wants, which is good, you know, and in terms of, you know, the show is accomplishing what it's set out to accomplish. But man, like, and again, won't go into any details about how everything evolves, but just to not spoil any plot elements. But man, I mean, and Mike, you've watched more of it than I have, but
yeah.
Just me personally, that was definitely jarring.
I don't know why they chose to start it that way, because like you said, that's your first episode. It's not like there's character development beyond this because it's an anthology series. So right. It's just okay, here it is. But it's just like Twilight Zone. That's the best comparison for it, because Twilight Zone did, and I love the Twilight Zone so much, was it really looked at like the fears of the day and did a lot of like social discussion, but did so through the actual plot of the stories and whatnot. So that's what this is kind of doing. And so the video that they end up seeing in the first episode is on YouTube, and they managed to get it pulled down, but at that point it's out there and everybody ends up seeing it because it goes viral. And so then of course the media picks up on it. And so, I mean, if there's a moral of the story, it's kind of warning of how those elements really combine to make things, you know, develop, you know, I don't know what I want to say. It's just like they blow up everything. And if you look at today's news coverage, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, one little thing happens yeah. and everybody talks about it forever. Even if it's trivial, even if it's, you know, Kardashian, or if it's, you know, something scandalous or whatever. I mean, they thrive on scandal. I mean, it's ridiculous. And so that's what this is kind of, this first episode was underscoring. It wasn't, you know, the idea was kind of putting the prime minister in this episode in a position where he had to, not only, you know, he either had to do something just completely horrible or...
And illegal, by the way.
And illegal, or do nothing, which would also be horrible. And the thing is, at the same time, everybody was watching and everybody would know if he did or didn't and would know the results of it. And so he would have to deal with that. And there was a point in there where they were talking about, like, polling data about this. And it's like, yeah, that's pretty apparent, too. It's like... You know, the political system and how much is based on only how it's going to play out there, and not necessarily how it is right, wrong, or whatever right. moral and, dilemma it is. So that's another kind of wrinkle that I found interesting in that particular episode.
Yeah, one thing that I thought was interesting about it was during the show, the polling data you're talking about revealed, okay, the British public is leaning one way. You know, I won't say what it is. And so it's like, you know, okay, they're leaning this way. Well, what does that mean for us? What do we do? Blah, blah, blah. And then something happens and something catches fire on Twitter about it. And then everything changes. Mm-hmm. And it's just like the snap of a finger. And just yeah. like you said, you know, how quickly things can divulge. And that was one of the more interesting aspects of it. Where you look at it and you say, okay, because the whole point of the show is kind of how technology has changed things and how it can change things and possible, you know, ramifications for our future. But it was really interesting when I kind of looked at it that way of saying, okay, you know, how interesting and how much someone's position can change without really doing anything. You know, it's just like these things, you know, we talk about internet memes and all that kind of stuff. These things take on a life of their own. And before you know it, you know, people are backed into a corner. They have no choice, basically, at least in terms of, you know, the court of public opinion. It's like, what do you do? So that was definitely a really intriguing aspect of it that, you know, if you strip away the vulgarity of this act that they're trying to force the prime minister to do, you know, that portion of it is rather interesting.
Yeah, and that's kind of the warning is like, okay, well, how malleable is opinion in that kind of environment? So this was probably of all the episodes, it's probably the least like futuristic. All the others kind of have some element of kind of speculation to it or advancements. The second episode is really interesting because it's like, it's more post-apocalyptic and it's,
yeah, I watched like the first 5 minutes.
Yeah. It's,
and I wanted to keep watching cause I was kind of intrigued, but the wife just shut it down immediately after that first episode.
Was like,
she
no,
was like, nope.
I don't want to see anymore.
If it's going to get this crazy, then no, we're not. So I was like, that's fair.
Yeah. but it's, you know, it's looking at like distractions and, you know, how people try to distract themselves from everything basically. But, you know, it's really interesting for that. And it's visibly just incredible. Really. It's really cool. As far as like a sci-fi kind of thing. And the third episode is kind of heartbreaking in its way. It's about like an implant that can store memories and project them so that you can share them. But, you know, and all of these are kind of like, you know, the story of the monkey's paw where you can make a wish, but the wish always has some kind of like
a catch.
Yeah, there's always a catch. There's always a downside to it that you don't think when you make the wish. And that's a big part of all of these episodes is that, okay, well, we get this advancement, we get these things, but there's a downside and a darker side to all of it. And it's kind of like, you know, the episode title, Black Mirror. You look in a mirror, you see one thing, but there's a reflection and it's not always, you know, it's not the real thing. And, it's bastardized in one way or another. Or not, I mean, I guess that's dramatic for a mirror, but
right.
You know, it's different. It's not the real.
Sense.
Yeah, it's not the real thing. And so that's what really made it interesting for me. It was like, okay, this, you know, everything always has that element, and it's the same thing with Twilight Zone. You know, there's the guy in the desert who tried to stay asleep for 100 years, and so that the gold he stole would be more valuable. And it turns out that, you know, when he actually gets there, the gold's worthless. Or the guy who wants to be the best pool player is now locked in a purgatory where he has to play pool for all eternity. So it's all those things are like, you know, yeah, this is what I want, but then you have to kind of look and is that really what you want? And Twilight Zone did that, and this has that same spirit. I finished the last three episodes of it, and some of them get really, really weird and like tense. One of them is really almost heartbreaking in the way it goes. So I mean, it's a little bit of everything. It's not quite horror, it's not like terror, but it's also like a series where you kind of have to reevaluate where some of those things are, because, you know, it's the scariest part isn't that it's in the future, it's that it's in the not that distant future. And so, you know, you can definitely see where it would apply in today's world and what we do. And the kind of ironic thing is that I accessed this from a remote control on a TV that pulled it up through a signal in the air and has everything at my fingertips right there. So it's like, okay, well, that's fitting.
It feels like something where the whole series is, I've walked away from movies before where I've said, you know, I'm glad I saw it, but I never want to see it again. So it feels almost like it could be something along those lines, you know, where
that
intriguing,
first episode.
There's good ideas, and first episode definitely, but even some of the other ones. And it's interesting that third episode you talked about the implant.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we kind of discussed this, but there was a movie starring the late, great Robin Williams called The Final Cut. that was made, I want to say like 2001 or something. And I had never heard of it until a few years ago. A friend of mine turned me on to it, and I went and freaking bought it because I liked it so much. It's basically the same concept, right? Where they come up with these implants that you can put in your brain and at birth, right? Even in utero, basically. And every instant of your life is recorded. And it's really intriguing because then once you die, you know, the implant is taken out and they have these people called cutters, right? That, you know, basically edit it or cut it, quote unquote, your life into a 2-hour movie, more or less. And then it's called a rememory, where all the family comes and instead of having a funeral, they sit and they play this like 2-hour movie. And it's interesting, a couple things that really have always stuck out at me. Like, number one, you know, Robin Williams is one of these cutters, and he has to sift through, you know, I mean, how many hours, seconds, minutes in a lifetime for some of these people? And he has to sift through all of it. And there's this, you know, he has this program that you know, divides everything up into proper time and or into proper categories and all that. But, you know, I mean, there's weird things that he has to see that other people did, you know, where, you know, in one memory that he's reviewing, you know, it's this guy getting an award for being a humanitarian. And then, you know, he skips to the next scene and the guy's beating his wife or something, you know? So it's like, you know, it's that really kind of strange dichotomy of, you know, do you show them the man they thought they always saw? Do you show them who he really was? You know, whatever. But then there was a scene after one of these rememories where the guy who had died, his brother came up to him and was like, "Hey, did you change the color of that boat when we were on the fishing trip?" In his memory, and he goes, "No, it's against policy to do anything like that. We never would." And so the brother is just like, "Man, I swear that boat was red, but it was green in that memory. You sure you didn't change it?" He's like, "Absolutely not." You know, so I always thought that was interesting because so many things in our lives are based on not even really our memory, but our perception of our memory, you know? And so, like, you know, if that boat was green in that guy's memory, who knows? Maybe a lot of things in his life would have been different. I mean, it's kind of weird to say that a color of a boat could impact, but, you know, maybe he always liked the color red because he thought that was a red boat, and he bought a red car and he got into a car accident and he hurt his leg and he lost the football scholarship, or, you know, I mean, who knows? Never, you know, it's interesting to kind of think along those lines. And I always thought that was the most intriguing. So I have no idea if that's where that episode 3 kind of goes in that same territory, but
it's pretty, it kind of got close. Me thinking. Yeah, it's you know, I mean, memories, there are always good memories and some things you want to remember and some things you don't want to remember, or some things that, well, in this case, someone else remembers that you don't want to know. So, you know, that's the whole thing with that, that third episode, which was really interesting and well done too. There's an episode that kind of deals with the persistence of people on social media and how much, you know, your personality is tied into that, which was pretty pertinent. So that was interesting, and that was the tough episode because it was just like the way that they did it was the way they kind of gave that lesson or lecture, however you want to take it, was it was just rough. And then just the rest were, you know, the interest of like, what can we do? How do we, I can't really talk about the fifth episode because it'll spoil way too much of it. But the last episode deals a lot with, or at least the sixth episode, I think there's like a special and there's probably more on the way, but the sixth episode is like, how easily you can sway people from paying any kind of attention. It's kind of like almost the first two. It's like, okay, how easy can people be swayed just by, you know, a joke, and how much do you get into actual substance of issues, and how much is of the political process is just for show, and who's really in it to do anything. So but it's basically like a cartoon bear who runs for parliament. So like a wisecracking cartoon bear, like fake Ned as a cartoon bear, runs for parliament.
Wait, isn't fake Ned already a cartoon? I'm confused.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. You're right. You're right. He's just not British.
Ah, there you go.
That we know of. So I think it's an interesting show. I want to see more of it. And because right now, you know, the way the British TV is, it's so weird. They do, I think, shorter seasons and shorter runs on series. So we'll see how long it goes. But like, I have 50 episodes of The Twilight Zone on my DVR right now from the New Year's marathon. So, you know, I'm ready to do a comparison at any time because, you know, I think I like that idea of those stories where you're thinking one thing and there's a twist, and it's not like a twist for twist's sake, but it's a twist because there's some unseen element in the bargain that you didn't consider.
Yeah,
something that a downside that you didn't consider or anything like that. So I think it's worthy to call it like a newer Twilight Zone. I think that's a high praise in my book because I love Twilight
Zone. Absolutely.
But
and I think that's kind of a little bit also of some disappointment in that first episode because I didn't as much see a twist.
It was more like 24 than Twilight Zone.
Yeah,
it was such a weird first episode for that series.
Yeah, so I'm gonna give the series another go, and then we can have maybe more discussions. And you know what? In the future, maybe we'll just spoil stuff so we can fully talk about it and just give full on spoiler alerts. And who cares? But
And disclaimers so the people can drop out if they're just looking for Royals talk. So.
Yes, exactly.
Which if you stuck around this long, well, whatever.
Yeah. So
I don't have to tell you.
So yeah, we will. I think that'll kind of wrap things up for us today. But again, trying a little something new. And if you like it, drop us a line, Twitter. I'm at The Jeff Report. Mike is at Michael Engel. So E-N-G-E-L, not G-L-E, in case you were curious. But
a lot of people mess that up.
It's, I would imagine. So yeah, hit us up there or the Kansas City KC Baseball Vault at gmail.com. Just KC Baseball Vault, no the, right? Oh, yeah.
It's been so long since we looked at that. There's probably stuff in there like,
please,
you study your playoff rotation? Wow, I don't know.
Email us. But yeah, somehow get in contact with us. Tell us if you like it. Tell us if you want us to talk about anything else, movies, TV, whatever. You know, we've got some extra time, and we still like making podcasts. So we're going to shake things up, and we're going to talk about whatever the hell we want to talk about, because that's what is going on. But right. We'd like you to be involved as well. So if you got something particular you want us to discuss, let us know. And if we're able, we will do it. So hope you enjoyed it. it's been a great show. Hopefully we got some more Royal stuff to talk about and or, you know, just other crap, whatever. So we'll be trying to turn these out as much as possible in the off season. Yeah. So thanks for stopping in. This has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn for Michael Engel and myself, Jeff Herr. Thanks for stopping by, and as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.